This is episode 307 of That Shakespeare Life. Patrons of our show get special extras. Like today, there's an extended version of this episode available on Patreon. When we recorded our conversation with Nick Fields, we were delighted to discuss the history of Lepanto for well over an hour. But in order to keep our show on track for time and in keeping with our typical programming length, today's show has been edited down for time. If you would like to see the full, unedited version of this interview featuring all the extra history content on the Battle of Lepanto, as well as 16th century history of the Ottoman Turks, you can find the full episode available right now on Patreon.com/thatshakespearelife.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kat from Reading the Past on YouTube. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
Where the soldiers would actually stand ready to board the enemy vessel, because the main purpose of these galleys was to actually close against each other, grapple, fire their cannons just before they made contact, hoping to destroy the opposite number, not sink, because it's very unusual to sink these vessels, but basically these cannons were basically to clear the decks before they were boarded the enemy vessel.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
In 1571, William Shakespeare was only 7 years old, but the naval battle that occurred that year was pivotal for England, and indeed the Christian world, that continued to be celebrated and written about for centuries after Shakespeare. The Battle of Lepanto was this battle, and it was the last naval battle fought exclusively with rowing vessels, known as galley warfare. And overall, it was a surprising naval victory for Catholics in particular. Even James VI would write poetry titled Lepanto that was in high demand as printed literature in England well into the start of the 17th century, and Shakespeare himself even references this work in some of his plays. Here today to discuss with us the geopolitics of the day and the Ottoman Empire that Shakespeare refers to as the general enemy Ottoman in 1603 is our guest and author of the book titled The Battle of Lepanto, 1571, Nick Fields. Dr. Nick Fields earned his bachelor's degree in ancient history and was also awarded the Senior Johnson Prize in Classical Studies. He has a PhD from the University of Newcastle, and he was granted a Hellenic government scholarship to further his PhD studies at the British School at Athens, Greece. He is the author of his most recent book, The Battle of Lepanto, 1571, The Madonna's Victory, that details the war history and naval history of this unique battle. We'll link you to more information on Nick Fields and where you can get a copy of his book in the show notes for today's episode. Hello, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Cassidy. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
The Battle of Lepanto remains famous today as the last naval battle fought entirely by rowing vessels, known as the Infantry of the Sea. Nick, explain briefly for the uninitiated, what is galley warfare and why was this battle significant in terms of the ships for naval war history?
Okay, well, first of all, the galley itself, the warship of the Mediterranean in the 16th century, the period we're talking about, Lepanto, it was basically a long, sleek, narrow, shallow vessel entirely made of wood. And it was oar-powered, i.e. muscle-powered. And the main purpose of this vessel was not actually sailing, although they did have rather rudimentary sails when you compare them with square-rigged vessels of the Atlantic or the Pacific. We're looking at a triangular sail, three masts, but one of the main masts held a triangular or what was called a lateen sail. As I said before, the main purpose of this vessel was to be oared powered, i.e. using human muscle power. The idea of this vessel, because it was very long and very shallow, it wasn't very seaworthy. But as you've got to appreciate, the Mediterranean is an inland sea with no tide to speak of. You're really at the mercy of the winds. And in fact, the Mediterranean is notorious for its winds. So the period in which you could actually use your warship was between, say, May and the beginning of October. So, in fact, when you look at the Battle of Lepanto, which actually took place in October, this was just outside the season for the use of these warships. Now, the ship itself had been developed way in antiquity. We know that the Greeks, for example, the Athenians of the 5th century BC, had a great warship known as the trireme, which was also powered by oars. Also, when we go to Rome and its empire, it also used the oared vessel, the trireme, the quinquireme, and larger vessels like that. But the big difference between our period, the 16th century, and in the period of Greece and Rome, was the fact that the oarsmen were mainly slaves, usually convicts, i.e. people that had been done in a court of law and deemed criminals, and then they were sent off to row in the vessels of whatever country they came from, or they were captives in war. So they could be Christian slaves if they were rowing in the Ottoman fleet, or they could be Muslim slaves if they were rowing in a Christian fleet. And so the main bulk of the oarsmen were slaves chained to their oar. You can think of that famous film of, in Ben-Hur, the famous film.
Ben-Hur, yes.
Yes, when he's chained to his oar. He's known as oarsman.
That would be Kirk Douglas.
No. It's actually not. It was,
Charlton Heston?
Charlton Heston.
That's it.
Yes. But you have to, he was known as slave number 41. But you have to remember, Rome didn't actually use galley slaves. That was a historical anachronism, because in this period, Greece and Rome were skilled oarsmen. They had to be professionals to do the maneuvers they used to use the ram. But in our period, we're using artillery. We're not using a ram. So your oarsmen just pulled an oar as fast as they could in order to point their vessel in the right direction to fire the cannons which were in the front of the ship. I'll talk about the cannons a bit later. But you have to appreciate that the actual vessel itself was unseaworthy. The other problem was the capacity for carrying supplies meant that it couldn't carry much water. And you have to appreciate even an oarsman who was under a chain and slave had to drink at least 10 or 12 litres of water a day. I mean, a normal human being only drinks 2 litres. You know, you and I in a day would probably drink 1.5, 2 litres of water. But you have to appreciate that an oarsman sweating at his oar, he was probably pulling a stroke every 3 seconds. And his speed was probably about 5 nautical miles or knots at a steady pace. In battle, he could pull probably 12 nautical miles or 12 knots. That's a dash, which he couldn't keep up for long. But he was sweating profusely, even under, you know, even if it was raining, whatever. So you can appreciate that water was a premium on these vessels. But they, because of the constricted space, you're talking about a vessel 40 meters long, 5 or 6 meters wide. That's a very small space in which to cram something like 150, 200 oarsmen. On top of that, you would have 40 crew. These are sailors who are professionals who knew how to handle the rigging. And then on top of that, because it was a fighting vessel, you had something like 150 or 200 fighting soldiers. So you have something like 300 plus people crammed into this small space. Therefore, there's no space for provisions, no space for water. And therefore, the thing about the oared vessel this period, you could stay at sea for, say, a day, but at night you had to come in and find a safe haven to resupply your water, your food, etc., etc. So you can appreciate it was a very specialized warship, geared totally, as you mentioned before, for fighting land battles at sea. Now, when you consider the vessel, you have this vessel at the prow, i.e. the front end of the vessel. You, if you're talking about Christian ships, i.e. Spanish, Venetian, Savoy, Knights of Malta, Italian, that sort of thing.
And this group was called the Holy League, right?
Yes, we'll talk about the Holy League. The Holy League was the conglomerate of Christian states that Pius V, the reigning pope, had cobbled together to fight the Ottoman Turk. But normally they had 5 cannon spaced at the front of the prow. In the center was the largest gun, which was about a 50-pounder. This was a cannon proper. And then either side of that, there was a half cannon, which was probably a 12-pounder. So you're talking about a smaller piece. And then on the end, another two guns, which were Sakers, they were called. These were something like 6-pounders. So you have a 50-pounder, 12-pounder, 6-pounder at the ends. So you have five cannons. This is quite a lot of armament for a vessel this size. And then along the railings, along each the sides, you know, the port and starboard, and also at the stern, the rear, you would have little guns, which were called swivel guns. The reason they could be swiveled, they were small pieces firing small balls, usually grape shot. This was like bird scatter to be anti-personal weapons. But the main armament was the five cannons at the stern of the vessel. And on top of the position where the cannons were a fighting platform. This was a small area raised above the cannons where the soldiers would actually stand ready to board the enemy vessel, because the main purpose of these galleys was to actually close against each other, grapple, fire their cannons just before they made contact, hoping to destroy the opposite number, not sink, because it's very unusual to sink these vessels, but basically these cannons were basically to clear the decks before they were boarded the enemy vessel. And once they grappled and the two enemy ships were basically stern to stern, then there'd be a boarding action. The first aboard would try and board their enemy vessel and clear their decks and capture their vessel. So as you appreciate, it was basically land at sea. Quite horrific when you think about it.
Nick, give us an overview of the battle itself. What was the impetus for this battle? How long did it last? And what was the armament and soldier count on each side? Was this an even battle with equal defenses on both sides, or was there one side more overpowering than the other?
Okay, well, as I mentioned before, it was Pius V, the reigning pope, who managed to cobble together this Christian alliance, which was mainly composed of Habsburg Spain under Philip II. Then there were the Venetians, who supplied a bulk of the vessels for the Holy League fleet. But also there were allies or dominions of the Spanish Habsburgs. We're talking about Genoa, Savoy, Naples, Sicily, who all came under the crown of Spain. Then there were also the famed Knights of St. John, who are now based in Malta. These are the Hospitallers, as they were known. And also there were other smaller contingencies, like from Florence and the papacy itself. The one big absence on the Holy League fleet was the French themselves. But you have to appreciate that since 1543, the French had signed an alliance with the Ottoman Empire, and therefore they turned their back on the Holy League.
What was the year that they signed that alliance?
1543.
So 1543, okay.
3 decades before the Battle of Lepanto, which took place in 1571. So the French weren't included. Having said that, there were Frenchmen in the Holy League fleet. These were volunteers or gentlemen adventurers, but also a large number of the Knights of St. John were French. So they disobeyed their king, who was Charles IX at this period. And there's that famous line from C.K. Chesterton with his poem Lepanto, where he says, Charles XI is sitting yawning at mass, i.e. he's not even interested in this Holy League fleet. So that was the one big absence from the, and we're talking about the Catholic world. So we're not talking about the Dutch or the English, because as we know, they're Protestants, either Lutherans or Calvinists. So they were, although there were a couple of English adventurers who were Catholics, one was actually Stuckey, who was actually a Knight of St. John. And so there were a couple of Englishmen fought. As far as I know, there were no Dutchmen, because being strict Calvinists, they would not even consider being members of the Knights of St. John. So on that side, we have the Holy League fleet, and that was commanded by the half-bastard brother of Philip II himself. He was known as Don Juan de Austria, or as we know him as Don John of Austria. He was only 26 years old, but he'd already confirmed his capability as a commander. He'd already fought against the Moriscos. These were converts in Spain. This was a nasty civil war 2 years before the Battle of Panto. These were, remember, under the two Catholic monarchs, Isabella and Ferdinand of Aragon. They had finally cleared Spain of the Muslims in the south of their country. This was in the same year as the conquest of, or the discovery of America in 1492. But not all Moors left the peninsula, the Iberian Peninsula. Those who stayed were forcibly converted to Catholicism. They have had the choice of conversion or exile. And a lot of Moors decided to stay in places like Granada and Andalusia. But a lot of them, conversion was just sort of, naysay. They still practiced their Islamic religion. And we know that just 2 years before the Battle of Panto in 1569-70, there was a rebellion of these Moriscos against the Spanish crown. And Don Juan had been sent against them to basically liquidate them. He was no holds bar here. It was an awful, awful 2 year war in which they totally liquidated any Moors who would resist them. And you have to appreciate that many of the Spanish soldiers that took part in this civil war actually served on the ships of Lepanto. So they were hard bitten, already covered in glory and scars and all that. So the army that embarked on the ships of the Holy League fleet were a mixture. For example, if you look at the Venetian galleys, they were fully professionals. They'd been masters of the sea during the previous century, but they were now on a decline. But their vessels were manned not by slaves, but actually most of the rowers in the Venetian vessel were freemen or volunteers. But the unfortunate thing for the Venetians that they didn't have the manpower to man the fighting crew, whereas you normally expect 120, 150 fighting soldiers on a Venetian, any Christian ship. They were down to only 50, 60, or 80. So this was a problem for the Venetians. Whereas when you look at the Spanish warship, they packed them, 150, 180 fighting crew. Most of them were from the famed tercios, as they were called. These were the land soldiers that fought in the Flanders and also just recently in the civil war in the south of Spain. And these were professional soldiers, but not used to fighting at sea. That's the sort of two different sorts of warriors that fought on the Christian side. And then added to this, you had the Knights of St. John, who were professional fighters, who were also seamen because they spent their life at sea fighting the crusade, as they called it, against the infidel. So, but they only had three galleys at Lepanto, so they had a very, very small contingent. When you look at the Ottomans, they were slightly different. Their crews, all right, their oarsmen were mainly slaves, Christians, taken in combats or prisoners of war, in other words, or taken by raids. Their vessels were undergunned when you compare them with the Christian vessels. I said they had five on a Christian vessel, whereas only normally you had three guns on an Ottoman vessel. Their main gun tended to fire a stone cannonball, not an iron one, as you would find on a Christian vessel. Now, we would probably think stone is not a very good means of firing a cannonball, but believe it or not, they were quite good. But the only problem with a stone cannonball, it took a craftsman to make, whereas an iron cannonball was easily founded in a foundry. They were quick to produce, whereas a stone cannonball took some time to complete. So Ottoman vessels undergunned when compared with Christian vessels. In fact, we know at Lepanto, the Christians had twice as much artillery pieces than the Ottomans. They had something like 1,800 artillery pieces on their war galleys, whereas the Ottomans had something like 750, 800 pieces of artillery. As for the fighting crew, again, the Ottomans liked to pack their vessels with 150 plus fighting crew, but a lot of their fighters were irregulars, as we know. They weren't professional. They were called Azabs. These were people taken from the frontiers of the Ottoman Empire. They could be fanatics, but they tend to have no discipline. The best troops for the Ottomans were the janissaries. I don't know if you've heard of the janissaries. These were actually boys. No, this is an interesting story. Janissaries were fully professional soldiers, which was unusual in this period. They were boys, Christian boys, taken from the Balkans in what was known as the collection. They were aged 7 to 10. They were then taken to Constantinople or any other major city in the Ottoman Empire. And for 10 years, they were trained to be professional warriors for Islam. They were converted to Islam from their Christian religion. They had to take an oath of chastity, an oath to the Ottoman Sultan. In fact, they were slave soldiers. And also, they had to take an oath that they would take no other trade than war. So after 10 years of hard discipline and training, they were fully warriors. So in their early 20s, they became full janissaries. The janissaries were organized in what we would recognize as proper companies in a modern sense. An order, as it was called, would consist of something like 120 janissaries. They all swore an oath to the Sultan, to the Quran, and they swore an oath to each other. So there's this sort of very tight group cohesion among the janissaries. They also had each unit its own symbol or flag, which they would tattoo on their arms. So you can see how close-knit the janissaries are. In a sense, they were fanatics. Fanatics for Islam.
It's like Navy SEALs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
You can imagine, well, that's quite a good analogy there. A good one, that. Yes. Yes, in fact, they were. I mean, the janissary, it was first and foremost, they looked after each other. And then secondly, they were soldiers of the Sultan. They were trained in all weapons, but they were trained as use muskets, but also their primary weapon was the composite bow. This is this very technical bow, which was came out of the steppes. It was made of sinew, horn, and wood. It's not your usual self bow that we think of in the West. This is a very complicated weapon, which had a very high rate of fire. And it took, you know, I had to start as a boy to use this weapon because you had to think of pulling 120, 150 pounds with your arm. That's quite some, you know, that is something. I mean, you and I would not even pull it 2 inches from its stave.
No, if that.
If that, yes, if that. But their main weapon was, their main purpose was actually to, although they used a musket or bow, but they would drop these and then rush into combat. Their charge was their primary purpose. They were individual warriors and they were armed with these very vicious short swords, which they were used with great aplomb. I.e., with one flick of their wrist, they could take your head off. That was it. So these were warriors who were feared throughout Europe. I mean, if you went janissary to a Christian soldier, he would start running for his life because he knew he had no chance against these guys. And we know that Lepanto, there were 6,000, at least 6,000, maybe 10,000 of these janissary warriors. So they were very, they would have been feared by even the professional soldiers of Spain. I mean, these guys, you couldn't stop. As you said, they were Navy SEALs. I mean, they, once they got on your ship, you could say, that's the end of us. I mean, they were fanatics for decades. Oh, yes. I mean, we're talking about, you mean the janissaries? I mean, yes, the janissaries were up to the 19th century. They were finally crushed in 1826 by the Ottoman Sultan Mehmet Ahmed then, because one thing about the janissaries, they tended to mutiny on many occasions. If they didn't like what was going on or their rations or they had a umbrage with the Sultan, they had these cauldrons. They had usually 3 cauldrons per unit. And in the cauldron, each night they would cook their pilaf, as we know, their rice and their lamb, and they sit around these cauldrons and talk old war stories and compare their scars and, you know, this sort of soldiery stuff that, you know, these sort of elite warriors like to talk about. But if they were upset with anything, and, you know, they were very temperamental, being highly strung warriors, they would simply overturn these cauldrons And that was a sign that trouble was to come, i.e. they're going to mutiny. Trouble is the janissaries got too powerful for the Ottoman Sultan. So in the end, he had to put them down. There was a rebellion, final rebellion in 1826, and they were finally crushed. So after that date, they disappeared. But up to then, I mean, especially in the 16th and 17th century, they were soldiers par excellence throughout, you know, the Ottoman Empire, but also Europe itself. You know, they were soldiers to be feared.
Certainly, majorly to be feared, and with a wide-reaching reputation. I mean, for decades, the Ottoman Turks had terrified Europe. They were ruthlessly persecuting Christians. And even Shakespeare refers to the Ottoman Empire in his play Othello as, quote, the general enemy Ottoman. So they were a scourge for a lot of countries at this time. And I feel like that was one reason that the Battle of Lepanto and the success here of the Holy League was celebrated, because it poked a hole in that sort of inevitable scourge that was sweeping across the continent.
You have to appreciate the Ottoman Turk himself was not originally an Islamic follower. They were people out of the steppe. People like Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, all those before, came out of the steppe as horse warriors and converted to Islam. But as you know, there's nothing like the converted. So under Selim, we see this expansion of the Ottoman Empire and the title Caliph. Now, the son of Selim was Suleiman. The Western world knew him as Suleiman the Magnificent, but his people knew him as the Lawgiver. Now, Suleiman was a brilliant sultan, well-educated. He gave new laws to his people. But having said that, he himself, like his father before him, when he came to the throne in 1520, was a warrior sultan too. In fact, he's the last sultan to personally lead his armies in battle. He served on 13 campaigns, leading personally his armies. And even at the age of 60 plus, he was still leading his Ottoman armies. Now, Suleiman, well respected by all the courts in the West because of his education, and he was also one for peace. And his main enterprises were against the East, in particular the Persian Empire of the Safavid Shahs. He manages to conquer most of Persia, which then adds another part of the Islamic world under his throne. But you have to appreciate there was a big difference between the Sunni, which still exists today, the Sunni Islamic religion of the Ottomans, and the Shiite religion of the Persians. There was great hate between those two. And as you know, it still exists today in the Middle
East.
Still
is, yeah.
Absolutely nothing changed on that score. But with the victory of Sunni Islam over Shiite Islam, you can see again the Ottoman Empire becoming greater than it was before. The one thing that Suleiman had a problem with in the West was the Knights of St. John. When he came to the throne, he was faced with the island of Rhodes, which, as you know, is right in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. It's right up against what is now modern Turkey. And Rhodes was the bastion of the Knights of St. John. And these were crusaders, as you want. They were still fighting the old medieval war against Islam, the infidel, as they called them. And each year they sent out their galleys, their warships, usually 12 they had in number, what were known as caravans. For 6 months, they would sail the Mediterranean and basically attack all Islamic Muslim vessels, merchant warships, and take their crews, enslave them, because as you appreciate, the Knights of St. John used slave oarsmen to power their warships. They also plunder their merchants and everything else. Even Christian vessels weren't safe from the Knights of St. John. So these, basically, you say, I mean, Suleiman called them pirates, pirates that wore crosses on their cloaks. Suleiman had a problem with the Knights of St. John. So in 1522, 2 years after he came to the throne, he led a great expedition against the island of Rhodes, and he managed to take it from the Knights of St. John. They were taken off the island in the 1st of January in 1523, and they were homeless. But fortunately, Charles V, the Habsburg emperor, the father of Philip II, I know there's lots of names floating around here, but he gave them a gift of the island of Malta. And that's where they are based until Napoleon kicked them off in 1797. So Suleiman sorted that problem out. But his other problem was also the Balkans. And we know that in 1526, he takes Belgrade, you know, which is the current capital of Serbia. So you can see that he's pushing the frontiers of the Ottoman Empire further west, which causes a problem for the Western courts, especially the Habsburg Empire, which is right on the frontier of the Ottoman Empire. So as you can appreciate, the Ottomans were a big problem for the European courts. And in particular, in the Mediterranean in 1538, there was a great defeat of a Christian fleet. This was the first Holy League fleet, which had been cobbled together by the reigning monarch, reigning pope in Rome. And in 1538, this fleet was destroyed by the Ottoman Turks under Barbarossa. Have you heard of Barbarossa, the red beard? He was actually a Greek.
Yes.
Yeah, Barbarossa, famous for his red beard. But he was actually a Barbary corsair. Now, part of the Ottoman Empire consisted of these dependencies on the northern African littoral. So we're looking at Tripoli, Tunis, Algiers. You've heard of these places, which are now in Libya.
Yes, of course. Well, they're in song here in the US for our Marines. Yes.
That's right. Yes, from the halls of Montezuma. Yes, was it Tripoli? Was it the famous?
Tripoli, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, in the 16th century, well, these three main locations, there were other locations, of course, but the Algiers, Tripoli, and Tunis were actually run by what we call the Barbary corsairs or pirates, whatever you were. These were originally independent concerns, mainly run by Christian converts. Like Barbarossa himself was originally a Greek Orthodox fisherman from the island of Lesvos or Mytilene in the eastern Mediterranean. But he'd been captured as a slave, rowed in a fleet, and converted to Islam. And once you convert to Islam, under the Islamic law, no Muslim can enslave a fellow Muslim. So they're given their freedom, but they still rowed in an oar. But men like Barbarossa rose through the ranks and became, as you know, he became an admiral of the Ottoman fleet. He also became the lord of Algiers and had his own fleet of Barbary corsairs. But under Suleiman, these Barbary concerns, Tunis, Tripoli, and whatever, actually became dependencies of the Ottoman Empire. They were a useful tool for Suleiman. He projected his power further west into the Mediterranean. As you can appreciate, Algiers, for example, is quite just below Spain and Italy. So basically, these are a big problem for the courts of the Christian world. And it was Barbarossa who destroyed this Christian fleet, the first Holy League fleet, in 1538, the place called Preveza, which is a port on the western side of the Greek mainland. This was actually where Actium, have you heard of Actium, the Battle of Actium, 31 BC, Antony and Cleopatra, famous film.
And a play, as it turns out.
That's play as well, exactly. Yes, Antony, it's in Cleo. Yes, so it was not far from the same site of that grand battle. In fact, Actium, up till the time of Lepanto, was the largest oared vessel battle we know of. So, and Lepanto became the greater battle after that. In fact, not far from Actium too, in fact, there you go. So it was not far from the site of Actium that Barbarossa managed to destroy the first Holy League fleet. So again, another big concern for the Christian world. And in fact, after Preveza, we know that basically the eastern half of the Mediterranean was now ruled firmly by the Ottoman Turk.
And I mean, you've identified that this battle was between Catholics and Muslims, and that England abstained from the battle on religious grounds, being Protestant under Elizabeth I. However, with this win at Lepanto, it's been celebrated in all of Christendom for centuries after the battle itself. Even James I of England would write poetry about Lepanto that was published in the 17th century. So what can you tell us about the response to the Battle of Lepanto in Protestant England in the year 1571? What did people in England think about this battle?
Even the Pope himself, Pius V, had qualms about whether or not this expedition against the Ottomans would be successful. So you can see that even, as you said in before, Protestant England, when they heard of the victory, there was mass celebrations. Elizabeth actually ordered that there were masses be sung in the churches of England. There'd be bonfires, there'd be jollities, festivals, you know. And you considered that the year before, in 1570, Elizabeth herself had been excommunicated by Pius V. Because as you can appreciate for the Catholic world, especially with what was known as the Counter-Reformation, this was the backlash against the Reformation when people like the Dutch, the Huguenots, the English became Protestants, either Lutheran or Calvinist. England itself was considered a nest of pirates, i.e. think of Drake, Frobisher, attacking Spanish merchant ships, especially in the New World, to take their gold and silver, and also a nest of heretics. Because remember Philip II himself, having married Mary Tudor when she was the elder sister of Elizabeth, who ruled for 5 years as a Catholic queen in England, and under her rule, there was a bloody period of Protestants being burnt at the stake and all this. It was an awful period for Protestants. And actually, technically, Philip II was the consort and actually could claim the throne of England because under the Catholics, especially the Pope and Philip himself, Elizabeth A was a bastard. I mean, the marriage of Anne Boleyn to Henry VIII was not recognized by the Catholic Church. And therefore, not only being a bastard, she was a heretic. And therefore, she had no right to be ruling England. And in fact, Philip II had a claim to that actual throne. So you can see that the fact that Protestant England under Elizabeth celebrating this Catholic victory was incredible. But you have to appreciate in Elizabeth's eyes, although she'd been excommunicated, and being excommunicated, that means she could be assassinated by her own subjects. Pius, when he issued that bull, said all subjects of Elizabeth could turn their back on her, forget the oath they swore to her as the Queen of England, and had every right to liquidate her. And we know that in 1570, when Shakespeare was 6 years old, in London, a gentleman, a Catholic known as John Felton, put this bull of Pope Pius V actually in a prominent place on one of the palaces in London for all to read. And actually, the bull actually said that subjects of Elizabeth had every right to forget their oath, allegiance to the crown, and could assassinate her. For his troubles, poor old Felton was hung, drawn, and quartered. But probably Shakespeare, even though he's 6 years old, the fact that she celebrates this Catholic victory is incredible. But for her and her subjects being Protestants, it wasn't a Catholic victory, it was a victory for Christendom. That was the main difference in their eyes.
Everybody in the Christian world felt a little safer after this win, I think.
Well, absolutely, because Lepanto really showed the Christian world, whether you're Catholic or Protestant, that the Ottoman Turk was not so terrible as he was before. In fact, it showed that he was not invincible. And in fact, it meant he was now bottled up in the eastern half of the Mediterranean and the western half was safer for all that. You know, people felt a lot safer. It's like the bogeyman had disappeared, you know.
James I of England, who is also James VI of Scotland, famously published a poem titled Lepanto about this naval battle. Nick, why was the King of England writing poetry about this battle?
It was not actually James I of England at the time. When he wrote the poem, he was only 12 years old, believe it or not. It was in 1583 when he wrote the poem. He was 12 years old, and so he was only James VI of Scotland at the time. And it wasn't actually published until 1591 in Holland, believe it or not in Scotland. But in Lepanto, as the epic poem, it's about 11,000 lines long. It's a great, I don't know if you've read it, but it's quite turgid, but it's quite an eye-opener because James, you have to remember, although born of a Catholic mother, his early childhood was actually grim, nasty. Ooh. He was actually under the tutorage of a strict Calvinist. Now, you think of Protestants, either Lutheran or Calvinist. Calvinists were pretty extreme. And the Calvinist that tutored the young James was George Buchanan. He was a great humorist, a scholar, and statesman. And basically physically hammered Calvinism into the brain of James VI, who became the wisest fool of Christendom, as we know him. He was a very strict Calvinist. But it's strange that he writes this poem, because even at the very beginning of the poem, he actually says, "This is a victory won by a papist bastard." He makes no bones about the fact that he's talking about a Catholic hero here. But it's very interesting that, again, like Elizabeth, he looks upon the victory of Lepanto, which he celebrates, you know, although it was won by this papist bastard, that it was a victory for Christendom, not for just Catholicism. And as the poem progresses, you know, it's quite turgid and, you know, you probably fall asleep reading for it. But he actually, in the end, he tends to twist the whole thing. Suddenly you think this is not a Catholic hero. He's suddenly become a Protestant prince who's battling against the heretics, the infidel, and that. It's a very clever poem in that respect, where it's very political. And this is a 12-year-old prince who's writing this, you know, not an adult. So he's actually twisted the whole thing, but it's all political. But it's basically, again, a Christian victory over the Muslims. But it was actually published a few years later in 1591, as I said again, in Holland. It was a great favourite in Holland because they were strict Calvinists, and they liked this idea of this poem celebrating a Christian victory. And you also have to remember, for them, it was like an allegory where it represented their own war, religious war against the Catholics led by Philip II. Remember, they had long, terrible wars in Low Countries, as we know, in the Belgium and Holland today, against their Catholic enemies. So in a sense, it was like representing their sort of victory, eventual victory of the Calvinists over the Catholic. So it's like an allegory, you know, the Christians over the Muslims, and for the Dutch, it became the Calvinists over the Catholic. So this is why it was a popular poem in the Dutch world. But anyway, that was James VI and his literary era. He also produced a second book of poetry, I think, in a later period. And actually, Shakespeare himself, in 1604, I believe, when he produced Othello, actually makes a reference to the poetry of James I, as he was now. He just came to the throne the year before in 1603. So when he celebrates the ascension of James I, as he's now known, Shakespeare was well aware of this poem written by the young prince, as he was then. So there's a wee connection there between Shakespeare and Lepanto as well. But also Shakespeare makes allusions to Lepanto in three of his plays, I believe. In Othello, as we know, we have the War of Cyprus with Othello the Moor, who is a Muslim fighting for on behalf of Venice against the Ottoman Turk. But also there's a reference to Lepanto in Much Ado About Nothing, because that's set in Messina, which was the point of departure for the Holy League fleet. So we get references to the battle there. And also in The Tempest, which is celebration of Don Juan, or Don John, as he's known in English, King of Tunis. He's self-styled by Shakespeare, and it's to do with his marriage, because we know that Don John, as Shakespeare knew him, knew he couldn't inherit the throne of his brother, being a bastard, and had designs on his own kingdom. I think he first thought about conquering Albania from the Ottoman Turks. We know in 1574 he conquered Tunis, but only held it for a year. He wanted to set up his own kingdom and rule there as a king. But he lost it the following year because in 1575, the Ottoman Turks took it back. But Shakespeare made allusions to Lepanto in at least those three plays as well.
Cervantes, the famous literary author behind Don Quixote and other publications, was actually present at the Battle of Lepanto, albeit a very young man and way prior to his being a literary success. But Nick, tell us about Cervantes' story at this event.
He was only 24 when he fought at Lepanto. He was a man on the run. We know he was the son of a deaf barber surgeon. Now, a barber surgeon was basically cut him open and bleeding sort of chap. He wasn't a physician. The physician was actually a university-educated doctor. But they had assistants who were known as barber surgeons, who not only cut hair, but they would bleed patients and do the sundry jobs for the physician. So his father was a impoverished physician, barber surgeon, assistant to a physician. They were actually of aristocracy descent, but they have fallen on hard times. Cervantes, as a young man, actually got an education from the Jesuits. He ends up in Madrid as a young man, where he was educated, but for some reason he fell foul of the law. He was involved in a duel. He managed to injure his opponent, who was a famous architect. But unfortunately, the duel took place in the confines of the royal palace in Madrid. And the law said that nobody should bear a sword in the confines of the royal palace. And if they were caught, they would lose their right hand. Cervantes didn't want to lose his right hand, so he ran away from Spain. Yeah. And he ends up, runs for his life, basically. There was apparently an edict against him, like he was an outlaw, and anybody captured him would get a bounty. So he ends up in Rome, and he becomes, I suppose, a servant, the chamberlain of a papal nuncio of Italian stock Roman. The nuncio didn't answer his background. He just knew he was a well-educated Spanish gentleman, but he only served this gentleman for only about a year. He got bored, apparently. And he and his brother Rodrigo, who was younger, decided to go and join the Spanish army. They were recruiting. This was in 1570, the year before Lepanto. They were recruiting soldiers down in Napoli, Naples. So he and his brother sign up. And that's how he ended up at the Battle of Lepanto. He was just a private soldier in one of the companies of the Tercio. He served on La Marquesa. This is one of the Spanish warships, galleys. And on the actual day of the battle, 7th of October, Sunday, he was actually ill and below decks. He had a fever. He probably had pneumonia or something. He actually refused to stay sick in bed. He came up on deck, reported to his captain, Diego Don Urbano, and said, "Look, I've joined the cause. I'm not going to stay below decks, even though I'm ill. I'm going to fight for the Holy League." And all his comrades said, "You're a fool," but said, "No, I'm going to do it." So he's shaking with fever and all that. So he actually fought in the battle. And we know he received three wounds, two in the chest and one in the left hand. The left hand was crippled for life. He lost the use of his left hand. But as he says in the preface to his first part of Don Quixote, he says, "I lost the use of my left hand for the glory of my right. I'm now a literary artist, and my right hand is earning my living." And he goes on to say that, "I'm very proud I fought in Lepanto, blah, blah, blah. It was the greatest day of my life, blah, blah, blah." And he actually repeats this in one of his last novels, The Journey to Parnassus, which he wrote in 1615, just the year before he died. He actually finished it on his deathbed. And again, he repeats the fact that Lepanto was the greatest day of his life. He lost the use of his left hand to the glory of his right. So you can see that Lepanto is actually a big thing in the life of Cervantes. We have two of his surviving plays. You have to appreciate that he still served as a soldier after Lepanto. He was recommended by Don Juan himself, who actually visited him in the hospital where he was lying having his wounds fixed, he was given a bounty and he was promoted to become a captain of one of the companies of the Tercio when he got back to Spain. Unfortunately, he never made it back to Spain because in 1575, on board one of the warships, it was actually taken by Barbary pirates and he was taken off in chains down back to Algeria. And there in Algeria, he served 5 years as a captive, rowing in the Barbary fleet, doing hard labor and stuff like that. So actually, he spent 5 years along with his brother, Rodrigo, as a captive in the Barbary state of Algiers. He actually tried to make 5 escape attempts. He was caught each time. He became famous, even among the Barbaries, because of his attempts to escape. But also, he was very erudite, and he was writing stuff with his right hand then. He was forming ideas for his novels in later life. But if you look at 2 plays, one is called Life in Algiers, and the other one's called The Prisoners of Algiers, you actually see many references to his existence as a captive in Algiers. There's also a big section of Don Quixote in part 2 of that big tome, which is known as the Captive's Tale, where Don Quixote meets a captive who also served at Lepanto, and we presume that the captive is actually a sort of allusion to Cervantes himself, where the captive has this long monologue in Don Quixote. There the captive talks about the Battle of Lepanto, the experience of being a soldier, of crossing from one ship to the other, boarding action, the terrifying aspect of hand-to-hand combat on one of these lurching vessels, no escape other than dropping in the sea or death itself. It's a very vivid description. And obviously, Cervantes is drawing on his own experience of that day. But what we gather from these many allusions, especially from the 2 plays and this long monologue in Don Quixote itself, is that Cervantes had post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. You know, this is a modern concept. It wasn't recognized at the time. I mean, we don't get it recognized until the probably First World War, where we call it shell shock. But now it's fully recognized as a, you know, it's not just combat soldiers, because anybody who experiences an accident, be it a road accident or a fire in a house. And it's assumed that the modern scholars read these sections of Cervantes' work and they fully appreciate that this guy, after his experience of the battle, but also the 5 years of captivity, was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And it pops up all the time in his work. I mean, there's many, many allusions to his own experience, not only the battle, but the fact he spent 5 years as a chained slave.
Well, I know there's so much to explore. I want, if you could recommend some starting points. Obviously, you've referenced several plays by Cervantes and a couple of publications by James that we'll definitely link to and check those out. But what are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use to learn more?
Well, the best modern scholarship is, I say it's modern, it's actually written in, well, I suppose it's not that old, 1974, but Professor John Francis Jr. Gilmartin. He wrote this definite tome on galley warfare in the 16th century. I mean, if you want to understand the nuts and bolts of galley warfare, 16th century, that is the book to read. In the bibliography in my book, we'll give you all the references to the vast output on Lepanto, 16th century warfare. There's also books on the individual states of the period. There's books on Philip II worth reading. There's a book on Venice by John Julius Norwich. He talks about the history of Venice, but also more important for the rise of Venice as a sea power. I do recommend one novel, believe it or not. There's this written by this Japanese lady, Nananomi Shokugune. It's a difficult name to say, but she wrote a book simply called The Battle of Lepanto.
We will place links to all of these resources in the show notes for today's episode, including The Battle of Lepanto 1571 by Nick Fields, which was a recent book club selection for That Shakespeare Life. So if you'd like to see our chat about this book specifically, you can join us on Patreon to see that. We'll place links to some of the recommended reading, as well as links to the primary documents Nick recommends you check out in relation to the Battle of Lepanto, all in the show notes for today's episode. So stay tuned for the URL for where to find those. Now, Nick, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
I thought about, obviously, Don Quixote, but in the end, I decided, because my expertise is actually in the ancient world, antiquity, classical history, so I would take with me Herodotus's histories. Herodotus, who lived in the 5th century BC.
What's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
I have another podcast to do, this time for an Australian gentleman, on another book I wrote. This is actually on Roman history, AD 69, which was known as the Year of the Four Emperors. So I have that next month. I'm actually writing a book at the moment. It's about what is known as the Jugurthine War. This was the war between Rome at the end of the 2nd century BC, so before it was a great empire, this is Republican period, against the Prince of Numidia. Numidia is actually modern Tunisia and part of Algeria.
It sounds like you're keeping busy and getting to explore history, which is always a good thing.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes.
Nick Fields, thank you so much for being here today and taking us through the Battle of Lepanto and talking with us about what it was like for Shakespeare's lifetime when this battle actually occurred. It's been fun talking with you, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Cassidy. It's been a pleasure, obviously. Okay, bye-bye. A biento.
A biento.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to see visuals and artifacts that go along with our conversation today, then check out the show notes for today's episode. I have pulled together images of galley ships, maps of the various locations across the Mediterranean that we're talking about, as well as portraits of some of the key players like Cervantes and Don John of Austria. And you can see these things in the show notes that go along with today's episode. Find all of these things at CassidyCash.com/episode307. That's CassidyCash.com/EP307. If you'd like to go beyond the episode and really step inside turn of the 17th century England for yourself, then consider becoming a member of That Shakespeare Life on Patreon. Patrons get to see behind-the-scenes content, including over 150 additional episodes of our show, not available on public listening platforms. They also get insider versions of our show with unedited video versions of our interviews with our guests. You'll also find printable educator resources, a film library featuring virtual tours and historical documentaries, as well as an entire collection of digital history activity kits that let you try out games, recipes, and crafts straight from the life of William Shakespeare that you can do at home or in your classroom. There's a whole lot of fun history extras, and it's a great place to hang out with other Shakespeareans who love this part of history as much as you do. Find out more and join us today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.